Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Canceler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Canceler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler, featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much.
So, I'm going to show you today an interview I conducted with Carmen Brange, who's a instructor at Ryerson University, and he ran afoul of the accommodation bureaucracy last year, and I interviewed him about his story, and I'm going to show you the letter that was written to him too, because he was threatened with action from the Ontario Human Rights Commission, that appalling organization. But before I do that, I want to set the context. So I'm going to show you a video from The Little Mermaid, and then I'm going to read a short story by Kurt Vonnegut called Harrison Bergeron. And then I'm going to read you two columns, and then I'm going to show you the interview, and then I'm going to close it off with a quote from Nietzsche, a fairly lengthy quote from Nietzsche. Now, you might remember in Disney's Little Mermaid that there's a mermaid named Ariel who's striving to rise out of unconsciousness, that's the watery ocean, and to establish a relationship up in the conscious world with a real man. And in order for her to do that, she has to have her own voice, and she has to be an autonomous creature that can function in the real world instead of remaining half unconscious, which is symbolized by her watery dwelling place and also the fact that she's half fish. So she needs her voice, just like Pinocchio needed his voice in the Disney movie Pinocchio. And remember, it was stolen from him by tyrants, essentially by authoritarian tyrants on Pleasure Island as a consequence of his impulsiveness on Pleasure Island, whereas Ariel's voice is stolen from her by Ursula, who's the wicked witch who lives under the water, who wants to keep everyone unconscious. And she's the terrible Oedipal mother and a rising political force. And so I'm going to start with that video where Ursula sings a song about poor unfortunate souls as she prepares to remove the voice, the logos, right, the thing that makes chaos or makes order out of chaos, the divine individuality, as she prepares to remove that from Ariel.
My dear sweet child, that's what I do. It's what I live for, to help unfortunate merfolk like yourself. Poor souls with no one else to turn to. I admit that in the past I've been a nasty. They weren't kidding when they called me, well, a witch. But you'll find that nowadays I've mended all my ways, repented, seen the light, and made a switch. 2 years. And I fortunately knew a little magic. It's a talent that I always have possessed. And here lately, please don't laugh, I use it on behalf of the miserable, lonely, and depressed. Pathetic. Poor unfortunate souls in pain, in need. This one longing to be thinner, that one wants to get the girl, and do I help them? Yes, indeed. Those poor unfortunate souls, so sad, so true. They come flocking to my cauldron, crying, spells, Ursula, please, and I help them. Yes, I do. Now it's happened once or twice. Someone couldn't pay the price, and I'm afraid I had to rake them across the coals. Yes, I've had the odd complaint, but on the whole, I've been a saint to those poor unfortunate souls. You'll have your looks, your pretty face, and don't underestimate the importance of the body language. The men up there don't like a lot of blabber. They think a girl who gossips is a bore. Yes, on land it's much preferred for ladies not to say a word. And after all, dear, what is idle prattle for? Come on, then, knucklemen impressed with conversation. avoided when they can. But they don't in swoon and fawn on a lady who's withdrawn. It's she who holds her tongue who gets a man. Come on, you poor unfortunate soul. Go ahead, make your choice. I'm a very busy woman and I haven't got all day. It won't cost much, just your voice. You poor unfortunate soul. It's sad, but true. If you want to cross a bridge, my sweet, you've got to pay the toll. Take a gulp and take a breath and go ahead and sign the scroll. Pops and jetsam, now I've got her, boys. The boss is on a roll. This poor unfortunate soul.
My point is that an excess of compassion deprives people of their individuality and their spirit. And that means that they have to live in unconsciousness, which is, of course, what Ariel would be doomed to live under the water, because the water is symbolic of unconsciousness. Without her voice, she can't make a relationship with a man, and she also can't speak her mind, right? Because she has no mind of her own. She has been deprived of her voice. And anyways, I'm hoping that this rather strange jumble of material will cohere into a reasonable story with the proper point. Now I'm going to read a short story by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. called Harrison Bergeron. The year was 2081, and everyone was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for instance, still drove people crazy by not being springtime, and it was in that clammy month that the HG men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son, Harrison, away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel couldn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. George and Hazel were watching television. There were tears on Hazel's cheeks, but she'd forgotten for the moment what they were about. On the television screen were ballerinas. A buzzer sounded in George's head. His thoughts fled in panic like bandits from a burglar alarm. That was a real pretty dance, that dance they just did, said Hazel. Huh, said George. That dance, it was nice, said Hazel. Yep, said George. He tried to think a little bit about the ballerinas. They weren't really very good. No better than anyone else would have been anyway. They were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked so that no one seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face would feel like something the cat dragged in. George was toying with the vague notion that maybe dancers shouldn't be handicapped. But he didn't get very far with it before another noise in his ear radio scattered his thoughts. George winced. So did two out of the eight ballerinas. Hazel saw him wince. Having no mental handicap herself, she had to ask George what the latest sound had been. Sounded like someone hitting a milk bottle with a ball-peen hammer, said George. I'd think it would be real interesting hearing all the different sounds, said Hazel, a little envious. All the things they think up. Said George. Only if I was handicapper general, you know what I would do, said Hazel. Hazel, as a matter of fact, bore a strong resemblance to the handicapper general, a woman named Diana Moon Glampers. If I was Diana Moon Glampers, said Hazel, I'd have chimes on Sunday, just chimes, kind of in honor of religion. I could think if it was just chimes, said George. Well, maybe make them real loud, said Hazel. I think I'd make a good handicapper general. Good as anybody else, said George. Who knows better than I do what normal is, said Hazel. Right, said George. He began to think glimmeringly about his abnormal son, who was now in jail, about Harrison. But a 21-gun salute in his head stopped that. Boy, said Hazel, that was a doozy, wasn't it? It was such a doozy that George was white and trembling, and tears stood on the rims of his red eyes. Two of the eight ballerinas had collapsed to the studio floor and were holding their temples. "All of a sudden you look so tired," said Hazel. "Why don't you stretch out on the sofa so as you can rest your handicap bag on the pillows, honey bunch?" She was referring to the 47 pounds of birdshot in a canvas bag which was padlocked around George's neck. "Go on and rest the bag for a little while," she said. "I don't care if you're not equal to me for a while." George weighed the bag with his hands. "I don't mind it," he said. "I don't notice it anymore. It's just a part of me." "You've been so tired lately, kind of wore out," said Hazel. "If there was just some way we could make a little hole in the bottom of the bag and just take out a few of them lead balls. Just a few." "2 years in prison and $2,000 fine for every ball I take out," said George. "I don't call that a bargain." If you could just take a few out when you came home from work," said Hazel. "I mean, you don't compete with anyone around here. You just sit around." "If I tried to get away with it," said George, "then other people would get away with it. And pretty soon we'd be right back to the Dark Ages again, with everybody competing against everybody else. You wouldn't like that, would you?" "I'd hate it," said Hazel. "There you are. The minute people start cheating on laws, what do you think happens to society?" If Hazel hadn't been able to come up with an answer to this question, George couldn't have supplied one. A siren was going off in his head. "Reckon it'd all fall apart," said Hazel. "What would?" said George blankly. "Society," said Hazel uncertainly. Wasn't that what you just said?" "Who knows?" said George. The TV program was suddenly interrupted for a news bulletin. It wasn't clear at first as to what the bulletin was about, since the announcer, like all announcers, had a serious speech impediment. For about half a minute, and in a state of high excitement, the announcer tried to say, "Ladies and gentlemen." He finally gave up and handed the bulletin to a ballerina to read. "That's all right," Hazel said of the announcer. "He tried. That's the big thing. He tried to do the best he could with what God gave him. He should get a nice raise for trying so hard." "Ladies and gentlemen," said the ballerina, reading the bulletin. She must have been extraordinarily beautiful because the mask she wore was hideous, and it was easy to see that she was the strongest and most graceful of all the dancers, for her handicap bags were as big as those worn by 200-pound men. And she had to apologize at once for her voice, which was a very unfair voice for a woman to use. It was a warm, luminous, timeless melody. "Excuse me," she said, and she began again, making her voice absolutely uncompetitive. "Harrison Bergeron, age 14, she said in a grackle squawk, "has just escaped from jail where he was held on suspicion of plotting to overthrow the government. He is a genius and an athlete, is under-handicapped, and should be regarded as extremely dangerous." A police photograph of Harrison Bergeron was flashed on the screen upside down, then sideways, upside down again, then right side up. The picture showed the full length of Harrison against a background calibrated in feet and inches. He was exactly 7 feet tall. The rest of Harrison's appearance was Halloween in hardware. Nobody had ever borne heavier handicaps. He'd outgrown hindrances faster than the HG men could think them up. Instead of a little ear radio for a mental handicap, he wore a tremendous pair of earphones and spectacles with thick, wavy lenses. These spectacles were intended to make him not only half blind, but to give him wanging headaches besides. Scrap metal was hung all over him. Ordinarily, there was a certain symmetry, a military neatness to the handicaps issued to strong people, but Harrison looked like a walking junkyard. In the race of life, he carried 300 pounds. And to offset his good looks, the HG man required that he wear at all times a red rubber ball for a nose, keep his eyebrows shaved off, and cover his even white teeth with black caps at snaggletooth random. "If you see this boy," said the ballerina, "do not, I repeat, do not try to reason with him." There was the shriek of a door being torn from its hinges. Screams and barking cries of consternation came from the television set. The photograph of Harrison Bergeron on the screen jumped again and again as though dancing to the tune of an earthquake. George Bergeron correctly identified the earthquake, and well he might have, for many was the time his own home had danced to the same crashing tune. "My God," said George, "that must be Harrison." The realization was blasted from his mind instantly by the sound of an automobile collision in his head. When George could open his eyes again, the photograph of Harrison was gone. A living, breathing Harrison filled the screen. Clanking, clownish, and huge, Harrison stood in the center of the studio. The knob of the uprooted studio door was still in his hand. Ballerinas, technicians, musicians, and announcers cowered on their knees before him, expecting to die. I am the Emperor, cried Harrison. Do you hear? I am the Emperor. Everybody must do what I say at once. He stamped his foot and the studio shook. Even as I stand here, he bellowed, crippled, hobbled, and sickened, I am a greater ruler than any man who ever lived. Now watch me become what I can become. He tore the straps of his handicap harness like wet tissue paper, tore straps guaranteed to support 5,000 pounds. His scrap iron handicaps crashed to the floor. Harrison thrust his thumbs under the bar of the padlock that secured his head harness. The bar snapped like celery. Harrison smashed his headphones and spectacles against the wall. He flung away his rubber ball nose, revealing a man that could have awed Thor, the god of thunder. I shall now select my empress, he said, looking down on the cowering people. Let the first woman who dares rise to her feet claim her mate and her throne. A moment passed, and then a ballerina arose, swaying like a willow. Harrison plucked the mental handicap from her ear, snapped off her physical handicaps with marvelous delicacy. Last of all, he removed her mask. She was blindingly beautiful. Now, said Harrison, shall we show the people the meaning of the word dance? Music, he commanded. The musicians scrambled back into their chairs, and Harrison stripped them of their handicaps, too. Play your best, he told them, and I'll make you barons and dukes and earls. The music began. It was normal at first, chilly, cheap, silly, and false. But Harrison snatched two musicians from their chairs, waved them like batons as he sang the music as he wanted it played. He slammed them back into their chairs. The music began again and was much improved. Harrison and his empress merely listened to the music for a while, listened gravely, as though synchronizing their heartbeats with it. They shifted their weight to their toes. Harrison placed his big hands on the girl's tiny waist, letting her sense the weightlessness that would soon be hers. And then, in an explosion of joy and grace, into the air they sprang. Not only were the laws of the land abandoned, but the law of gravity and the laws of motion as well. They reeled, whirled, swiveled, flounced, capered, gambled, and spun. They leaped like deer on the moon. The studio ceiling was 30 feet high, but each leap brought the dancers nearer to it. It became their obvious intention to kiss the ceiling. They kissed it. And then, neutralizing gravity with love and pure will, they remained suspended in air inches below the ceiling, and they kissed each other for a long, long time. It was then that Diana Moon Clampers, the handicapper general, came into the studio with a double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun. She fired twice, and the Emperor and the Empress were dead before they hit the floor. Diana Moon Clampers loaded the gun again. She aimed it at the musicians and told them that they had 10 seconds to get their handicaps back on. It was then that the Bergeron's television tube burned out. Hazel turned to comment about the blackout to George, but George had gone out to the kitchen for a can of beer. George came back in with the beer, passed while a handicap signal shook him up. Then he sat down again. You been crying, he said to Hazel. Yup, she said. What about? He said. I forget, she said. Something real sad on television. What was it? George said. It's all kind of mixed up in my mind, said Hazel. Forget sad things, said George. I always do, said Hazel. That's my girl, said George. He winced. There was the sound of a riveting gun in his head. Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy, said Hazel. You can say that again, said George. Gee, said Hazel. I could tell that one was a doozy. Harrison Bergeron is copyrighted by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., 1961. So I'm going to read you a column that was published in the National Post by Professor Bruce Pardy, who teaches law at Queen's University. The column is based upon an article that was published in the Education and Law Journal. It's entitled, Mental Disabilities Shouldn't Be Accommodated with Extra Time on Exams. Last week at the World Track and Field Championships, Usain Bolt ran his final race. Andre DeGrasse, the Canadian sprint star, missed his last chance to beat Bolt because of a hamstring tear. If, instead of pulling out of the race, DeGrasse had claimed accommodation for his injury and demanded a 20-meter head start, no one would have taken the request seriously. Yet an equivalent accommodation is standard practice at Canadian universities and colleges. They award extra time on exams and assignments to students who claim mental and cognitive impairments. extra time for mental disabilities is as unfair to other students as a head start would be to other runners. Human rights legislation does not prescribe such measures. The practice is illegitimate and inconsistent with the law. The number of Canadian university and college students claiming mental disabilities has increased dramatically in the past decade. Depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, learning disabilities, and attention deficit and hyperactivity disorders are common conditions. Some are permanent and others temporary. Some are constant and others recurring. Typically, only a medical note is required to get accommodation, even though many clinicians rely on self-reported symptoms to measure impairment. At some universities, students need not even disclose the nature of the condition they claim to suffer. A typical accommodation is an additional 50% of the time allotted, an extra hour for a two-hour exam. Provincial human rights commissions insist that these extra time accommodations are necessary. These commissions are not neutral investigative bodies, but advocacy agencies with expansive agendas and wide powers to interpret and apply human rights code provisions. On this subject, their directions are inconsistent with prevailing principles of human rights law. Their confusion is in part a product of the tangled concept of discrimination. To discriminate means to distinguish or tell apart. While the law prohibits certain specific instances of discrimination, telling people apart is not illegal, but an essential tool for functioning in the world. People discriminate constantly. They choose to be friends with some friends. They choose to be friends with some people and not others. Employers hire better qualified candidates rather than those less qualified. Distinguishing between people even on prohibited grounds is proper if done for a bona fide purpose. The bona fides of any competition are the skills and abilities that the competition tests. The purpose of the race is to discriminate between people based upon their speed. Therefore, it also discriminates against people with disabilities that affect speed, but not in a way that offends the law. No accommodation need be made. Exams are competitions too. A student's grade depends largely upon how his or her performance compares to his classmates. When a professor awards an A to the best exam and a B to the middle of the pack, she discriminates between exams. Therefore, she also discriminates between students on the basis of their cognitive skills and mental abilities, how well they can think, learn, analyze, remember, communicate, plan, prepare, organize, focus, and perform under pressure. Discrimination is one of the purposes of the exam. That discrimination is not illegal or inappropriate. No accommodation need be made. Other kinds of disabilities can be accommodated because they are not what the exam is testing. Blind students, for example, may need to access exam questions with a text reader. Unlike extra time for mental disabilities, such accommodations create no undue hardships for other students in the class. Alicia Raimondo is a mental health advocate and a former student at the University of Waterloo, diagnosed with dyslexia, depression, anxiety, and Asperger's syndrome. Her attitude is typical. Students with mental disabilities, she told Maclean's magazine last year, quote, might have the smarts to achieve grades in the 90s, but will only receive 60s. Accommodations are about leveling the playing field, end quote. This claim is false. Extra time does not level the field, but tilts it. Given enough time, many students could put together a paper that would earn a 90 had it been produced within the 2 hours allotted for the exam. Claiming the right to extra time and then insisting what you produce is an A paper is like claiming that you should win the gold medal for the 100 meters by running only 80 meters. That logic cheats those who have accomplished more demanding tasks. There's only one gold medal and only a limited number of A grades. Pressure is part of the conditions of the test. Students who can exhibit proficiency only when sources of stress are eliminated are like athletes who can perform at their best only in practice rather than in the big game. Accommodating those students makes no more sense than accommodating the athletes. The proper purpose of accommodation is to facilitate participation, not to compensate for lack of ability that the test is about. Students who claim extra time for mental disabilities are already able to participate within the normally allotted period. They simply wish to increase their prospects for success at the expense of their peers. A little later, Margaret Wenta, a journalist for the Globe and Mail, wrote an article as a follow-up to Bruce Party's piece. She wrote, "Why treat university students like fragile flowers?" Here's what she had to say. Campus life isn't what it used to be. In the olden days, when you got stressed out at exam time, you pretty much had to suck it up. A little weed and jelly donuts sometimes did the trick. As for deadline extensions, forget it. If your grandma died, Professor McNasty didn't care. All that has changed. Today, any proper university has registered therapy dogs to cheer you up. If exams have you down, drop in for a lick and a cuddle and you'll feel better in no time. And if you're too depressed because of grandma, no problem. The disability office will provide you with a private room and extra time to write your final. Your professor never even needs to know. Today, colleges and universities are highly concerned with the mental well-being of their students. Student distress, we're told, is at an all-time high. It's the pressure, the competition, social media, career anxiety, long commutes, money worries, cyberbullying. Meanwhile, the definition of disability, originally used for physical issues, has expanded beyond all recognition. Now it includes not only learning disabilities, but all manner of mental, social, and cognitive disorders, anxiety, depression, OCD, ADHD, PTSD, and the like. These may also require special accommodation. As a consequence, universities now routinely give students extra time to write exams and finish assignments. But not all professors are happy about this. But it's not up to them anymore. It's up to the ever-expanding disability bureaucracy. Bruce Party, a law professor at Queen's University, thinks the accommodation industry has gone too far. Giving someone with mental health problems extra time to write an exam doesn't level the playing field, he says. It simply tilts the field against everyone else. As he wrote recently, quote, "The purpose of exams and assignments is not merely to test knowledge, comprehension, and analytical ability, but to do so under conditions that require poise, organization, forward planning, and grace under pressure." He says it's like letting someone with a limp start at the 20-meter mark in a 100-meter race. The results are meaningless. Sadly, Professor Party appears to be on the wrong side of this debate. A recent report prepared by a group of academics, with heavy guidance from disability experts and the Ontario Human Rights Commission, lists even more functional limitations that could require accommodation. They include, but are not limited to, memory, concentration, stress management, attention, communication, focus, and executive functioning, including planning, organizing, problem solving, sequencing, time management, and judgment, as well as, quote, "the ability to effectively manage the demands of academic life," end quote. I'm not kidding. Being totally unfit for the demands of academic life is no excuse for a university not to accommodate you. Universities have become massive therapeutic institutions where ensuring the social and emotional well-being of the students is job one. Any failure of the student is really a failure of the institution. This is essentially what two York University law professors wrote in a recent rebuttal to Professor Party. Quote, "Exams and assignments should not be exercises in testing mental health," end quote, they argued. Quote, "Legal education is not a race," end quote. The two authors, Benjamin Berger, Professor and Associate Dean of Students, and Lauren Sossen, Dean of Osgoode Hall Law School, argue that law schools themselves exacerbate the mental problems that students face. They need to be more inclusive, accessible, and fair. Who knew that law students were suffering so much? Sure, law school is a grind, but the payoff is good. Besides, it seems, anecdotally speaking, that students rarely flunk out these days. The schools see to that. Student satisfaction is important, and the students won't be satisfied if too many of them fail. As for real life, the part where you've got to finish that brief by Monday, no matter how fatigued, disorganized, and stressed you are, well, never mind that now. After all, real life is not a race or a test of mental health, is it? None of this is to minimize the gravity of serious mental problems or the anguish they cause. My point is that we are socializing young adults for fragility, not resilience. We're telling them that we don't expect them to endure unpleasant feelings such as anxiety, exam stress, and feeling overwhelmed, or unpleasant speech that makes them feel bad, or unpleasant experiences such as failure. We'll send them to the cuddly room to kiss the puppy and make it better. So hypothetically, all this move towards accommodation is supposed to be improving students' well-being and leveling the playing field. But it's not as if psychologists, for example, are united in behind the belief that this sort of thing is good for people. I'm going to read you an abstract from a paper that was published last year by Nick Haslam in a journal called Psychological Inquiry, an international journal for the advancement of psychological theory, volume 27, 2016, issue 1. The article's title is Concept Creep: Psychology's Expanding Concepts of Harm and Pathology. Here's the abstract. Many of psychology's concepts have undergone semantic shifts in recent years. These conceptual changes follow a consistent trend. Concepts that refer to the negative aspects of human experience and behavior have expanded their meanings so that they now encompass a much broader range of phenomena than before. This expansion has taken horizontal and vertical forms. Concepts extend outward to capture qualitatively new phenomena and downward to capture quantitatively less extreme phenomena. The concepts of abuse, bullying, trauma, mental disorder, addiction, and prejudice are examined to illustrate these historical changes. In each case, the concept's boundary has stretched and its meaning has dilated. A variety of explanations for this pattern of, quote, concept creep, end quote, are considered, and the implications are explored. I contend that the expansion primarily reflects an ever-increasing sensitivity to harm, reflecting a liberal moral agenda. Its implications, however, are ambivalent. Although conceptual change is inevitable and often well-motivated, concept creep runs the risk of pathologizing everyday experience and encouraging a sense of virtuous but impotent victimhood. So here's a few quotes from the paper. By increasingly including subjective elements into them, concept creep may release a flood of unjustified accusations and litigation, as well as excessive and disproportionate enforcement regimes. Concept creep can produce a kind of semantic dilution. If a concept expands to encompass less extreme phenomena, then its prototypical meaning is likely to shift. If trauma, for example, ceases to refer exclusively to terrifying events that are outside normal human experience and is applied to less severe and more prevalent stresses, it will come to be seen in a more benign light. By increasing the range of people who are defined as moral patients, people worthy of moral concern based on their perceived capacity to suffer and be harmed, it risks reducing the range of people who see themselves as capable of moral agency. There's a tendency for more and more people to see themselves as victims who are defined by their suffering, vulnerability, and innocence. The flip side of this expanding sense of victimhood would be a typecast assortment of moral villains, abusers, bullies, bigots, and traumatizers. And finally, expanding mental disorder can pathologize normal experiences, generate overdiagnosis and overtreatment, and engender a sense of diminished agency. So the dangers, by the way, of labeling are well known to the psychological community. It's no trivial matter to allow yourself to be diagnosed with a disorder that you define as disabling. And one of the things that I've seen as a professor at the university is that more and more students are doing precisely that, encouraged by the accommodation bureaucracy, let's say. They come to see themselves as lesser in some important sense in a way that means that they have to have additional accommodation. And the problem with that is that, well, the first thing is that once you define yourself as somehow lesser and needing accommodation, and then you act that out, the probability that you're going to come to believe it is extremely high. And of course, the second problem is that the ever-expanding domain of what constitutes an impairment necessary for accommodation risks destabilizing the entire assessment process. Now, the point of the assessment process is to show that it isn't to award someone an award for accomplishment. That's not what a degree is. A degree, for example, is an indication that a person can do a certain amount of work of a certain quality in a certain time compared to other people, all other things being equal. And if you destroy that by moving away from objective testing standards, then all you end up doing is destroying the degree. Now, of course, the degree's validity, university degree's validity, is being destroyed by all sorts of forces at the moment, but this is certainly one that's particularly pernicious. I'm also going to read the letter that Professor Branche received from the Ryerson University Chang School of Continuing Education from the Office of the Dean. Dear Professor Branche, you were the CECL for CITM 102 for fall 2016. A student in your class, redacted, was registered with Academic Accommodation Support, AAS, and as a disability-related academic accommodation required extra time to write both his midterm and his final exam. Redacted wrote his final exam on December 2016. You disagreed with the amount of extra time that was allocated for him to write this exam, and you are now refusing to return the completed exam to the Chang School, which gives redacted an incomplete for the course. The university has legal obligations under the Ontario Human Rights Code to provide accommodations to students who so require. The university system is for ensuring we comply with our legal obligation is established under policy 159 and is operated by AAS. It is not acceptable for you to unilaterally determine that a disability-related academic accommodation is or is not appropriate. In fact, your refusal to cooperate with the university process and to instead seek to award the student an incomplete may be in breach of the Human Rights Code. I'm instructing you to return the completed Ryerson exam to my office by no later than 5 p.m. on April 10th, 2017. Failure to do so is insubordination and will have disciplinary consequences up to and including the removal from teaching at the Chang School. I also wish to advise you that should the student file a human rights complaint, your actions are outside the scope of your employment responsibilities and you may be held personally liable for damages. Should you wish to discuss the accommodation provided or the process, we would be pleased to discuss setting up a meeting after the exam has been returned. Yours sincerely, Dr. Marie Bountrogiani, Dean. So, that's that. All right, I'm speaking today with Dr. Carmen Branche, who's a part-time lecturer at Ryerson University. He has degrees in computer science, management science, a master's degree, and a PhD in industrial engineering from the U of T. Carmen contacted me a couple of months ago about some issues that he was experiencing at Ryerson University, and he decided that he wanted to talk about them. So that's what we're doing today. So I'm gonna turn this over to Carmen so he can bring everybody up to date on his story.
Sure. So thanks very much for speaking with me. The reason I contacted you initially I think was probably going back when you first started making your videos. There was some, I was watching with my wife one of your interviews, I think, and you mentioned kind of just offhand about how you felt that the accommodation departments at schools have become, have gone overboard. And when I heard that, I jumped out of the couch, really, because I thought, geez, this is exactly what I'm experiencing right now. And I hadn't really heard too many people kind of express that idea before. So kind of several months later when this actually happened, so this happened in December of this year, this last winter semester, then this happened to me and I remembered hearing you speak about that. And then also, you know, you're pretty well known for speaking up on issues that are difficult to talk about, such as this, right? So yes, that's why...
It's very difficult not to be a villain when you start to complain about the accommodation of the disabled.
Exactly.
Of course,
exactly.
The devil's always in the details. And right. I spoke to plenty of academics off the record about their increasing trouble with the tyranny of the disabilities office and its its continual overreaching and expansion and compromising of academic integrity. So...
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know, there has to be a line somewhere. So I think it's approaching that line now. So I wanted to raise the alarm about this because.
Okay. So tell us what happened to you.
Okay. So, well, maybe just I'll take a quick second just to talk about my background a little bit more other than my degrees, because I know exactly the criticism that people are going to say about this is, do you not care about people with disabilities or do you not want to help people with disabilities? So that couldn't be more further from the truth. So in my academic career, although I wouldn't say I'm an expert on disabilities, my research focused very much on using technology to help people with disabilities. So for example, I worked on, in my undergrad, I worked on some software that creates video description for the blind. In my master's, I worked on a vibrotactile display that presented music to people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And in my PhD, I created a keyboard that would allow people to play music for people who are deaf. So the fact is, you know, I've been around people with disabilities. I've been working towards helping them. Mm-hmm. So it's very much been a part of my life, is helping people with disabilities.
Right. Yeah. You're not just working towards helping them either, by the sounds of it. You're actually helping them.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Actually,
which
doing
is a big
things.
Deal, man. That's exactly. A big deal. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I've taught at a number of colleges in the GTA, Ryerson and Centennial. And, so the latest incident happened at Ryerson, and this is only the latest, I should say. I've been teaching probably the last 6 or 7 years, and I've probably had one incident every year or so, maybe on average, maybe a little less than one per year. This is kind of just the latest one, and it seemed to me kind of the most egregious too. So anyways, I was teaching an intro to business technology course, which is just teaching, you know, students how to use Excel, teaching some introductory business concepts, Porter's Five Forces, things like that. So the course was going pretty well. And then the midterm came along, and I had some communication from the accommodation department saying a student I had was on a plan, an accommodation plan. You know, no problem. I'm used to that. A lot of, you know, maybe in a class of 20, two or three students will be on an accommodation plan.
Okay, we should probably give the listeners a little background about the whole accommodation issue, just so everybody knows.
Sure.
So basically, and you correct me if this isn't in accordance with your experience, basically there are disabilities accommodation offices at every university and college now, and they're put there as part of the government mandate to provide accessible educational opportunities for people regardless of their disability, basically.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Which seems like a perfectly reasonable issue. But what's happened is that's become, because it happens to be extraordinarily difficult to define precisely what constitutes a disability, and because bureaucracies once established, especially administrative bureaucracies, and perhaps particularly administrative bureaucracies in universities, tend to grow and expand their mandate once established. And so increasingly, a larger and larger proportion of students are being granted less and less clearly defined disabilities and asking for more and more accommodation. And so that's all seems right to you. That seems
agreed.
Okay. That's
totally
in keeping
agreed.
With my experience. And so I had just as a brief aside, I had a request from the disability office this year to consider allowing someone with a memory disability to bring notes of unspecified depth and complexity into a multiple choice exam.
Yeah.
And I mean, the obvious rejoinder to that is, well, what precisely is the nature of the memory disability?
Right.
And if the person has a memory disability that makes it unable to actually remember the course, why is it that they're taking the course to begin with?
Exactly.
Now,
And the other thing is that you're not allowed to ask. You said you didn't know the nature of the memory. It's in this rules that you can't ask what their disability is.
Yes, that's the other thing that we should specify. So the problem with this one was because I was asked to whether or not I would agree to this request. And I said, well, how the hell can I figure out if I'm going to agree to that request? I don't know anything about the person. I don't know anything about the disability. They said, well, you can decide what constitutes reasonable accommodation. I said, I have no information on which to make that determination.
Yep.
So you can decide, this is what I told the disabilities office, you can decide what constitutes reasonable accommodation. I can't. I'm not going to act as an expert in a domain in which I have no expertise. So no. Yep. And they said, well, we don't know. It's like, well,
yeah,
that's too bad because I'm not doing your job for you, so to speak. Okay, so that's a little more background for everyone. All right, so back to your story.
Sure. So I was notified a student was on an accommodation plan, and right around the midterm, when the midterm was coming up, I forget who reached out to who. I think they reached out to me because they needed a copy of the test. So during that conversation, I think kind of just offhand, I inquired, so like, how much extra time is this student being given? So I think the exam was, it was a midterm, it was maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, multiple choice exam. So everyone got 2 hours, and they told me the student was going to get 8 hours to write the midterm. And I was shocked. I remember because I was at work, and I was just really taken aback. It was really unexpected. I'd never heard of anything like that. And I was sort of just so surprised that I let that one go, because I was surprised. I didn't know what to do. Wasn't sure. Do I have the authority to override this or not? I kind of assumed I didn't. So he was given that amount of time to write the midterm. It's four times the amount of time, and so it's done in a separate room. They're given breaks so they can stop and start again. And I honestly don't know what you would do for those 8 hours on a multiple choice. Like, it was 60 multiple choice questions. It just seems like a really excessive amount of time. So fast forward to the final exam. Same thing. They wanted to give the student 8 hours to write the final. And at this time, I'd had a couple months to think things over, kind of gain some perspective. And maybe from listening to some of your videos, I gained some bravery, maybe some chutzpah. And I told them, I said, no, I don't accept this. You cannot give this student 8 hours to write the midterm, because you're fundamentally changing the task. You're not removing barriers. You're changing the task. Like, if I told you I did a marathon, but I took 2 weeks to do it, I can't really still call that a marathon at that point. It's a totally different task at that point. So I said, no, absolutely not. You can have 1 hour extra, right? I think that was 50%, which is still a lot. 1 hour extra in the room, that's fine. Any more than that, and I don't feel comfortable. So I was ignored. I had to kind of probe later on, how much time did you give this student? How much time? How much time? A couple emails later, finally came back. Oh, they were given from 8:30 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon to write this final exam. So obviously I did the only thing I can do, which I said, that's fine. I won't mark this exam. I'm not going to mark this. You went against my explicit wishes and just unilaterally gave the student 8 hours to write maybe a 2.5 hour final. And I said, no, I'm not marking this. The options are, you can have the student rewrite the exam, or the student gets an incomplete. For me, I can't really imagine any different course of action, because I can't put my stamp on it, on his grade, saying,
right,
this student understands this material and can and is capable of, doing X.
Right, right.
I can't.
So
I can't
do that.
One of the
things we should point out is that there's zero personal utility in you doing this. All it is for you is trouble.
Yep.
The simple thing for you to do would have been to nod and said, oh, I just don't have the time to deal with this, and just done exactly what you were asked. So what you're actually attempting to do is to maintain the integrity of the credential.
Exactly.
That's what you're trying to do. Yeah.
I have degrees from Ryerson too, so I have a little personal, gain in mind here, because I want the value of those degrees to be maintained. So in a way, I'm kind of being selfish, but you're absolutely right. It's only headaches. There's no real. This one particular case isn't going to protect my degree or whatever, right?
No. There's nothing in this for you except trouble, and there's also nothing in this for you in talking to me. Except trouble.
Yep.
Right. Exactly.
Yep.
So, okay. So fine. So you said, well, you didn't do what we agreed that should be done. And so you're basically usurping my position as the educational authority, and I'm not participating in this.
Exactly.
Okay,
because,
so,
I recognize, listen, my course is an intro course. It's an Excel course. At the end of the day, if they don't learn Excel, people aren't going to die. But where does the line go? Are accommodation people going to tell people in medical courses about what, who should be granted a medical degree? Like, you know, there's a line somewhere.
That is yes, that is exactly what's going to happen. That is exactly what is happening.
So, right now, maybe the consequences aren't severe and immediate, but I think if this bar keeps getting pushed, this is where we're going to end up, So.
Yes, well, and there's a more problematic issue underlying this, which is the definition of disability itself.
Right.
It's very difficult to define. Now, what used to happen, and I think this was far preferable, was that if a student had an emergency or a catastrophe of some sort, they would go talk to the professor and say, look, here's my personal situation. Here's the details. Would it be possible to adjust this in some manner so that I can still, because I'm still going to be competent, although, and I'm going to demonstrate that competence, but I can't do it in quite the standard way. And then the professor would think, well, is that reasonable? Does that undermine the academic integrity of the process? And then some private arrangement would be reached. And that was appropriate because it put the decision-making power in the hands of the person who was responsible for the credentialing.
Right.
And then some professors would be hard asses about it. And, maybe they wouldn't accept the excuse of a funeral, for example, and some would be softer, but that's okay. Yeah. It's okay that there is a variety of opinions. But now we're put in a position where we're acting as if disability constitutes a category. It's like, okay.
Right.
Well, you've opened a can of worms there like you cannot possibly imagine, because almost everyone either has a severe problem of one sort or another that's chronic or sporadic, or who has a family member who has a severe problem, or who has an economic problem that's a severe problem.
Yep.
So now you have to adjudicate each of those individually, and you can't do that. Now, the whole damn purpose of objective testing was to say something like, we don't give a damn about your problems. All we care about is your competence.
Yep.
And we'll fairly assess your competence, and that's the best we can do, because other than that, it's an unsolvable problem. But that's no longer good enough, so we get a mess like the one that you're describing, which is, and this is continuing to go out of control. I know that I was speaking with Janice Fiamenko at the University of Ottawa, who's now in front of the Ontario Human Rights Commission or the Human Rights Tribunal, I don't remember which it is, for failing to make reasonable accommodation. And as far as I could tell from talking to her, she had bent over backwards and twisted herself in knots to make reasonable accommodation. And the punishments for not doing so can be extraordinarily high, which is also an indication of the punitive, equity-oriented general environment that we happen to be living in at the moment. Okay, so then what happened?
Yeah, so that actually leads very nicely into kind of the conclusion. So again, I haven't marked the test. I refused. I still haven't. A couple of weeks later, I think in January, I got an email from the Dean of Continuing Education with a very formal looking and serious letter saying a number of things, one of which is that I may be violating the student's human rights.
Yeah.
By not allowing him 8 hours to write a 2-hour midterm, I'm violating someone's human rights. That doesn't sit well with me.
No, I bet.
And I don't see how a third party should really be involved in this, right? Like, it's kind of between me and the student, right? So a third party comes in and says, no, that's not going to work. To me, that doesn't sit well with me.
And claims that you're, I would say, properly motivated and somewhat, what would you say? You're taking a stand on principle that we've already pointed out has zero benefit to you personally, nothing but risk. And also talking to me, it's like, it's crazy that you're talking to me because you're a part-time lecturer. And, it just means that what it means under most circumstances is that you might as well kiss your part-time lecturing career goodbye. That's really what it means. Now, it may not turn out that way, but that's the risk you're taking.
Yep.
And now what you're being accused of is now you're a human rights violator. That's fun. That's the kind of thing, kind of letter you want to wake up to. Just out of curiosity, do you have that letter handy?
Yeah.
And if so, do you want to read it?
Let's see, because there's some personal information in there.
Yeah, well, don't read that.
Sure, okay.
But read it and also read the whole thing. Let's know who's let everybody know who's involved in this. Because my sense with these sorts of things is that the best thing to do is to air them in public. And we'll decide whether or not you're a human rights violator.
Okay, so this was from the dean of the School of Continuing Education, Dr. Marie Botragiani. And I believe she was an MPP at one point. So as an instructor for this course, a student in your class was registered with the academic accommodation support. And as a disability-related academic accommodation required extra time to write both his midterm and final exam. He wrote his final exam December 13th. You disagreed with the amount of time that was allocated for him to write this exam, and you are now refusing to return the... So there's kind of two issues here. They incorrectly thought that I had the test and was holding on to it, but I never did, because it was all done in the accommodation center.
Okay.
So they were kind of demanding that I return this test to them that I never had. So the university has legal obligations under the Ontario Human Rights Code to provide accommodations to students who so require. The university system for ensuring we comply with our legal obligation is established under Policy 159. And actually, I would like to read a couple of clauses from that policy in a moment. It is not, because I looked it up. It is not acceptable for you to unilaterally determine that a disability-related academic accommodation is or is not appropriate. In fact, your refusal to cooperate with the university process and to instead seek to award the student an incomplete may be in breach of the Human Rights Code. So then they asked me to return the test, which I never had. And I also wish to advise you that should the student file a human rights complaint, your actions are outside the scope of your employment responsibilities and you may be held personally liable for damages.
Great. That's the key phrase there, man. That's,
yeah.
So good. So you get to get hauled in front of the Human Rights Tribunal.
Yep.
And which will pay the legal costs of the person who takes the complaint and not pay your legal costs. And then impose whatever fines and other punitive damages might be required. And the probability that you would be found guilty if you were brought in front of the Human Rights Tribunal, from what I understand from discussing the issue with many lawyers who've had extensive dealings with the tribunal, is that your chances of being found guilty are in the high 90s.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what you're looking at.
Yeah. But I've extracted two clauses from the policy, actually, that specifically, because I looked all this stuff up, right? I didn't just do this kind of willy-nilly.
Yeah.
But so in the Ryerson's accommodation policy, there's a section where instructors will do, right? So this is 4B. So instructors will work with university stakeholders to accommodate academic accommodation support registrants who require specific accommodation while preserving the essential academic requirements of the course and the program.
Yeah, well, that's just the side clause.
Right. So to me, that means I followed the rules.
Yeah, it does mean you followed the rules.
Right. If you take a 2-hour test and give someone 4 hours to do it, you've ruined the academic integrity. Right.
Right.
And then another one. Okay, so this is 4G, clause 4G. An instructor will collaborate with academic accommodation support in structuring an appropriate accommodation plan that meets the needs of the student with a disability and satisfies the essential academic requirements of the respective course and program. So to me, that seems like they didn't collaborate with me, right? I tried to collaborate. I said, let's do something else. I don't like this. Let's try something else. And they said, no, we're just doing what we said. So to me, according to those rules, and I pulled them out of the context of the policy, but you can just Google Ryerson accommodation policy and see the whole thing.
Other thing that's happening is that because the number of disability claims is swelling.
Yep.
The amount of time that the disability officers, who are overloaded beyond belief, can spend assessing the credibility or lack thereof of any disability claim. And like, how are you going to do that if you're not a trained medical professional? Just to bring that up. And so what happens is the default position for every request is yes.
Yep.
Because how else can it be? Yes is easy. See, if you would have just said yes, that's easy. Yep. And you get to go back to your life.
Yep.
No means, oh no, I have to say no to someone who's claiming disability and who might be seriously disabled. So I'm a son of a bitch right off the bat.
Yep.
And then I have to dig into their disability claims and make a judgment about whether or not they're valid. And in comparison to all the other potential universe of disability claims, man, good luck. The thing, the answer to that is to say yes to all the requests. The consequence of that is the abandonment of that second clause, which is maintenance of the academic standards. And it's pretty damn interesting that when the dean wrote you, that there wasn't even any recognition of, because you actually have two responsibilities under that code.
Yeah.
One is to make appropriate accommodation, but the second, equally important, is to make appropriate accommodation while maintaining academic integrity. Because the other, see, the thing is, if you fail, and every academic, let's say, fails in the second regard, what that means is that everybody should regard a degree that's been granted to someone who has a disability as what would you call of potential dubious validity.
Yep.
So in fact, if you don't hold up the second part of the bargain, then you're working at counter purposes to the best interests of a disabled person, because what the disabled person wants is to be able to have a degree that says, look, I might be disabled, but I can bloody well do this. That's what that degree says. It doesn't say, well, because I'm disabled, people bent themselves over and twisted themselves into knots trying to find every possible way to give me this degree, even though I can't really do the work.
Yep.
Jesus, who wants a piece of paper like that?
No one.
Right.
And it, so it just begs the question, what's the end game for this? And what's the intention? So now we're, you know, maybe this type of stuff is appropriate in elementary school, high school maybe, but now we're getting into secondary school, even graduate school, this kind of stuff is happening.
Yeah.
So are we expecting that, so now when they go into the employment, into the private sector and they get a job, that employers are going to do this as well? When does it stop, right? I don't know, because the way we have it set up now is we're setting them up for failure in a much later in life where the consequences are way more severe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what we're doing. I've seen that with many students. Like I've seen many students who have been granted accommodation as undergraduates.
Exactly.
Would have been far more merciful. Yep.
Yes.
To have said to them in their first year, look, you can't do it.
Yep.
Instead, they spend 10 years getting their undergraduate, stumbling through, accommodated on every test, accommodated on every assignment, and also backing themselves further and further into a corner where they're defined almost entirely by their disability. So there's no upside here for someone. Okay,
no.
So look, that was good. Yep. So yeah, well, thanks for talking to me. And
no, thank you. Thank you. It's been an honor.
I wish we could have done it earlier. I think you're crazy to talk to me.
But
it's the right kind of crazy, because
I think so.
If you go along with this sort of thing and it violates, see, I'm at the point to some degree. I'm not at the point, but if something like what you described happened to me, and what I described to you with regards to the disability office happened to me 20 more times, my eventual response would be, you tell me what grade to give the person, and I'll just give them that grade.
Yep.
It's like, it's simple. It's, I'm not going to participate in the subterfuge and lying.
Yeah.
When it takes a tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
I'll just do the simple lie, which is, you've decided that you guys are the arbiters of who is disabled, how, and what the accommodation is. And so you can give the damn grade.
Yep, exactly.
And I'm out of it.
Yeah, so, that's how I feel. I mean, I like teaching. I love teaching, but I can't be a part of it if it's like this, right?
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I feel comfortable speaking. You know, I'm doing okay. So, and I'd love to teach more, but I think a lot of your videos had a lot to do with it too, is just is I feel that when you're not, when you don't act with integrity, it hurts you, right?
Yeah,
you get depressed, you feel bad, you're angry all the time, and you know, I don't need that. So I'd rather
neither do your students.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is from Friedrich Nietzsche. Of course, you probably know that he was the philosopher who announced the death of God. And what he meant by that was that the fundamental metaphysics that underlie Western culture had lost their foundation, and that the consequence of that would be the disintegration of the idea of value itself, especially of value hierarchies. And he thought of the inevitable consequence of that, or one of the inevitable consequences of that, a dramatic move towards a doctrine of radical equality. See, because if value itself is destroyed, the value distinction between things, so that not one thing is not any better than another, then there's no reason for hierarchies of virtue or of value. And so the equality doctrine is a logical outcome. So here's what he wrote about that. It's in Thus Spake Zarathustra, which is a somewhat poetic work, not really characteristic of most of Nietzsche's writings, but I think this is very useful quotation to end this off with. Behold, this is the whole of the tarantula. Do you want to see the tarantula itself? Here hangs its web. Touch it so that it trembles. There it comes willingly. Welcome, tarantula. Your triangle and symbol sits black on your back. And I also know what sits in your soul. Revenge sits in your soul. Wherever you bite, black scabs grow. Your poison makes the soul whirl with revenge. Thus I speak to you in a parable. You who make souls whirl, you preachers of equality. To me you are tarantulas and secretly vengeful, but I shall bring your secrets to light. Therefore I laugh in your faces with my laughter of the heights. Therefore I tear at your webs, that your rage may lure you out of your lie holes, and your revenge may leap out from behind your word, justice. For that man be delivered from revenge, that is for me the bridge to the highest hope and a rainbow after long storms. The tarantulas, of course, would have it otherwise. What justice means to us is precisely that the world be filled with the storms of our revenge. Thus they speak to each other. We shall wreak vengeance and abuse on all whose equals we are not. Thus do the tarantula hearts vow. And will to equality shall henceforth be the name for virtue. And against all that has power, we want to raise our clamor. You preachers of equality, the tyrannomania of impotence clamors thus out of you for equality. Your most secret ambitions to be tyrants thus shroud themselves in words of virtue. Aggrieved conceit, repressed envy, perhaps the conceit and envy of your fathers, erupt from you as a flame and as the frenzy of revenge. What was silent in the father speaks in the son, and I often found the son the unveiled secret of the father. They are like enthusiasts, but it is not the heart that fires them, but revenge. And when they become elegant and cold, it is not the spirit, but envy that makes them elegant and cold. Their jealousy leads them even on the paths of thinkers. And this is the sign of their jealousy. They always go too far, till their weariness must in the end lie down to sleep in the snow. Out of every one of their complaints sounds revenge. In their praise there is always a sting, and to be a judge seems bliss to them. But thus I counsel you, my friends, mistrust all in whom the impulse to punish is powerful. They are people of a low sort and stock. The hangman and the bloodhound look out of their faces. Mistrust all who talk much of their justice. Verily, their souls lack more than honey. And when they call themselves the good and the just, do not forget that they would be Pharisees if only they had power. My friends, I do not want to be mixed up and confused with others. Some preach my doctrine of life and are at the same time preachers of equality and tarantulas. Although they are sitting in their holes, these poisonous spiders with their backs turned on life, they speak in favor of life, but only because they wish to hurt. They wish to hurt those who now have power, for among those, the preaching of death is still most at home. if it were otherwise. The tarantulas would teach otherwise. They themselves were once the foremost slanderers of the world and burners of heretics. I do not wish to be mixed up and confused with these preachers of equality.
My dear sweet child, that's what I do. It's what I live for, to help unfortunate merfolk like yourself. Poor souls with no one else to turn to. I admit that in the past I've been a nasty. They weren't kidding when they called me, well, a witch. But you'll find that nowadays I've mended all my ways, repented, seen the light, and made a switch. 2 years. And I fortunately knew a little magic. It's a talent that I always have possessed. And here lately, please don't laugh, I use it on behalf of the miserable, lonely, and depressed. Pathetic. Poor, unfortunate souls in pain, in need. This one longing to be thinner, that one wants to get the girl, and do I help them? Yes, indeed. Those poor, unfortunate souls, so sad, so true. They come flocking to my cauldron, crying, spells, Ursula, please, and I help them. Yes, I do. Now it's happened once or twice. Someone couldn't pay the price, and I'm afraid I had to rake them across the goals. Yes, I've had the odd complaint, but on the whole, I've been a saint. To those poor, unfortunate souls, you'll have your looks, your pretty face, and don't underestimate the importance of a body language. The men up there don't like a lot of blabber. They think a girl who gossips is a bore. Yet on land it's much preferred for ladies not to say a word. And after all, dear, what is idle prattle for? Come on, then, not all that impressed with conversation. True gentlemen avoid it when they can. But they dote and swoon and fawn on a lady who's withdrawn. It's she who holds her tongue who gets a man. Come on, you poor unfortunate soul. Go ahead, make your choice. I'm a very busy woman and I haven't got all day. It won't cost much, just your voice. You poor unfortunate soul. It's sad, but true. If you want to cross a bridge, my sweet, you've got to pay the toll. Take a gulp and take a breath and go ahead and sign the scroll. Got some jetsam, now I've got her, boys. The boss is on a roll. This poor unfortunate soul.
Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Kanzler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Kanzler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler, featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much